thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. We're in the midst of a three-week, four-city university speaking tour that will take us not only to Sydney, but also to Brisbane and Melbourne and Adelaide. So we're delighted to have the opportunity to share with you today on the question of God's existence. And we've got a PowerPoint that will assist us here with this as soon as I get rolling. On April 8 of 1966, the American news weekly Time carried a lead story for which the cover was completely black, except for three words emblazoned in bright red letters against the dark background. And the words read, "Is God dead?" And the article described the movement among American theologians at that time to proclaim the death of God. But to paraphrase Mark Twain, it seems that the rumors of God's death were greatly exaggerated. For at the same time that the theologians were writing God's obituary, a new generation of young philosophers was rediscovering his vitality. This was something radically new. You see, back in the 40s and 50s, it was widely believed among philosophers that talk about God is literally meaningless because it can't be verified by the five senses. The collapse of this verificationism was undoubtedly the most significant philosophical event of the 20th century. The downfall of verificationism meant a resurgence of metaphysics. Along with all of the traditional questions of philosophy that had been suppressed by verificationism. And accompanying this resurgence came something new and altogether unexpected, a renaissance of Christian philosophy. The turning point probably came in 1967 when Alvin Plantinga published his book, God and Other Minds, in which he applied the tools of analytic philosophy to questions in the philosophy of religion with an unprecedented rigor and creativity. And in his train has followed a host of Christian philosophers, writing in the top professional philosophical journals, reading papers in the professional societies, and publishing with the top academic presses. And the face of Anglo-American philosophy has been transformed as a result. Atheism, though probably still the dominant viewpoint among philosophers, is today a philosophy in retreat. In a recent article, the University of Western Michigan philosopher Quentin Smith laments what he calls the desecularization of academia that evolved in philosophy departments since the late 1960s, complaining of naturalist the way intelligent and talented is entering academia today, Smith concludes, God is not dead in academia. He returned to life in the late 1960s and is now alive and well in his last academic stronghold, philosophy departments. And I'm very pleased to see green shoots of this same renaissance of Christian philosophy are now beginning to appear in Australia as well. This renaissance of Christian philosophy has been accompanied by a resurgence of interest in natural theology, which is that branch of theology that focuses on arguments for the existence of God apart from the resources of authoritative divine revelation. All of the traditional arguments for God's existence, such as the cosmological, teleological, moral, ontological arguments, as well as creative, new arguments, find intelligent and articulate defenders in the contemporary scene. Now, some might say, but what about the new atheism represented by people like Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and Christopher Hitchens and so forth? Doesn't that herald the soul of the mind? Well, not really. As is evident from the authors that they interact with, or I really should say the authors they fail to interact with, the new atheism is in fact a pop cultural phenomenon, lacking in intellectual muscle and blissfully ignorant of the revolution that has transpired in Anglo-American philosophy. It tends to represent the verificationism and scientism of a bygone generation and is out of touch with the contemporary philosophical scene. As a professional philosopher, I believe that the hypothesis of God's existence explains best a wide range of the patterns of human experience. And this afternoon, I'd like to share with you briefly 8 such data. Number 1, God is the best explanation why anything at all exists. Imagine that you were hiking through the outback, and you came upon a translucent ball lying on the ground. You would naturally wonder how it came to be there. If your mate said to you, "Forget about it, it just exists inexplicably," you wouldn't take that seriously. You'd think that either he was joking or else he just wanted you to keep moving. But no one would take seriously the suggestion that the ball literally just exists with no explanation. Now, notice that merely increasing the size of the ball, even until it becomes coextensive with the universe, does nothing to provide or remove the need for an explanation of its existence. So, what is the explanation of the existence of the universe? Whereby the universe, I mean all of space-time reality. The explanation of the universe can only be found in a transcendent reality beyond the universe, beyond space and time, which is metaphysically necessary in its existence. Now, there's only one way that I can think of to get a contingent reality like the universe from a metaphysically necessary cause. And that is if that cause is a personal agent who is endowed with freedom of the will and who can therefore freely create a contingent reality. It therefore follows that the best explanation of why the universe exists is a transcendent being, which is what everybody means by God. We can summarize this reasoning as follows. Premise 1, every contingent thing has an explanation of its existence. 2, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is a transcendent personal being. The universe is a contingent thing. Now, what follows from those 3 premises? Well, logically, it follows 4. Therefore, the universe has an explanation of its existence. And 5, therefore, the explanation of the universe is a transcendent personal being, which is exactly what everybody means by God. So I think that God is the best explanation of why anything at all exists. 2, God is the best explanation of the origin of the universe. We today have pretty strong evidence that the universe is not eternal in the past, but had an absolute beginning a finite time ago. In 2003, Martin Board, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin were able to prove that any universe which is, on average, in a state of cosmic expansion throughout its history, cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a past space-time boundary. And what makes the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem so powerful is that it is independent of any physical description of the early universe. Because we don't yet have a quantum theory of gravity, scientists cannot give a physical description of the very first split second of the existence of the universe. But the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem is independent of any physical description of that. Their theorem implies that the quantum vacuum state, which may have characterized the universe, cannot be eternal in the past, but must have had even if our universe is just a tiny part of a so-called multiverse composed of many universes, their theorem implies that the multiverse itself must have had an absolute. Now, of course, highly speculative scenarios such as a loop quantum gravity model, string models, even closed have been proposed to try to avoid this absolute beginning. These models are all fraught with problems. But the bottom line is that none of these theories, even if true, succeeds in restoring past. Last year, at a conference at Cambridge University celebrating the 70th birthday of Stephen Hawking, Vilenkin delivered a paper entitled, Did the Universe Have a Beginning?, in which he surveyed contemporary cosmology with respect to that question. He argued, and I quote, none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal. He concluded, all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. But then the inevitable question arises, why did the universe come into being? What brought the universe into existence? There must have been a transcendent cause which brought the universe into being. We can summarize the argument thus far as follows. 1. The universe began to exist. 2. If the universe began to exist, then the universe has a transcendent cause. Therefore, the universe has a transcendent cause. Now, by the nature of the case, as the cause of space and time, that cause must be an immaterial, non-spatial being. Now, there are only two kinds of things that I could think of that could possibly fit that description. Either an abstract object, like a number or a mathematical entity, or consciousness. But abstract objects don't stand in close relations. Perception, for example, has no effect upon anything. It therefore follows that the cause of the existence of the universe is an unembodied mind. And thus we are brought plausibly not merely to a transcendent cause of the universe, but to its personal creator. Number 3, what is the best explanation of the applicability of mathematics to the physical world? Philosophers and scientists have puzzled over what physicist Eugene Wigner called the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. How is it that a mathematical theorist like Peter Higgs can sit down at his desk and by poring over mathematical equations predict the existence of a fundamental particle which 30 years later, after investigation, spending millions of dollars and thousands of man hours, experimentalists are finally able to discover. Mathematics is the language of nature. But how is this to be explained? If mathematical objects are abstract entities, causally isolated from the universe, then the applicability of mathematics to the physical world is, in the words of philosopher of mathematics Mary Lang, just a happy coincidence. On the other hand, if mathematical objects are just useful fictions, then how is it that nature is written in the language of these fictions? The naturalist has no explanation for the uncanny applicability of mathematics to the physical world. By contrast, the theist has a ready explanation. When God designed the physical universe, he built it upon the mathematical structure that he had in mind. We can summarize this argument as follows. 1. If God did not exist, then the applicability of mathematics would be just a happy coincidence. 2. But the applicability of mathematics is not just a happy coincidence. 3. Therefore, God exists. Number 4. God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. In recent decades, scientists have been stunned by the discovery that the initial conditions simply given in the Big Bang were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent embodied life with a precision and delicacy that literally defied human comprehension. This fine-tuning is of two sorts. First, when the laws of nature are expressed as mathematical equations, you find them appearing in them certain constants, like the gravitational constant. The value of these constants are independent of the laws of nature. Secondly, in addition to these constants, there are arbitrary quantities that are just put in as natural conditions on which the laws of nature then operate. For example, the amount of entropy in the early universe. All of these constants and quantities fall into an extraordinarily narrow range of life-permitting values. Were any one of these constants or quantities altered by less than a hair's breadth, the balance would be destroyed and life would not exist. Now, there are three live explanatory options with respect to this extraordinary fine-tuning. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical chance or design. Physical necessity is not, however, a plausible explanation. Independent of the laws of nature. They are not physically necessary. So, could the fine-tuning be due to chance? Well, the problem with this explanation is that the laws of a life-permitting universe governed by our laws of nature are just so infinitesimal that they cannot be reasonably based. Opponents of chance refer to a remarkable metaphysical hypothesis, namely the postulation of a world ensemble of other universes, preferably in order and randomly ordered, so that finally universes would appear by chance somewhere in the ensemble. Now, not only is this hypothesis, to borrow Richard Dawkins' phrase, an unparsimonious extravagance, but it also seems to face an insuperable objection. For by far, most of the observable universe in a world ensemble will be universes in which a single brain fluctuates into existence out of the quantum vacuum and observes its otherwise empty world. Worlds like that are simply incomprehensibly more obvious in the world ensemble than finely tuned universes like ours. Therefore, if our world were just a random member of a world ensemble, we ought to be having observations like that. Since we don't, that's wrong. Disconfirms the world ensemble hypothesis. Thus, it is also not a plausible explanation. So the fine-tuning is not plausibly due to physical necessity or chance. It therefore follows that 3 is due to design. And thus, the fine-tuning of the universe constitutes evidence for a cosmic design. Number 5. God is the best explanation of intentional states of consciousness in the world. Philosophers are puzzled by states of intentionality. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, intentionality is the property of being about something or of something. It signifies the object directedness of our thoughts. For example, I can think about my summer vacation, or I can think of my wife. No physical object has this sort of intentionality. A chair or a glob of tissue like a brain is not about something or of something. Only mental states or states of consciousness about other things. A materialist, like the philosopher Alex Rosenberg, recognizes this fact. And so he concludes that on atheism, there really are no intentional things. Rosenberg boldly claims that we never really think about anything. But that seems incredible. Obviously, I'm thinking about Rosenberg's argument. This seems to me to be a reductio ad absurdum of atheism. By contrast, on theism, since God is a mind, it's hardly surprising that finite minds should also exist. And thus, intentional states fit comfortably within a theistic worldview. So, we may argue, 1, if God did not exist, intentional states of consciousness would not exist. 2, but intentional states of consciousness do exist, from which it follows 3, therefore God exists. Number 6, God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties in the world. In moral experience, a realm of moral values and duties which impose themselves upon us as objectively binding and true. For example, we all recognize that it's wrong to walk into an elementary school with an automatic weapon and to shoot little boys and girls and their teachers. But on a naturalistic view, there's nothing really wrong with this. Moral values are just the subjective byproducts of biological evolution and social conditioning. Rosenberg is brutally honest about the implications of his atheism. He declares there is no such thing as morally right or wrong. Individual human life is meaningless. Without moral value, we need to face the fact that we believe in truth. By contrast, the theist grounds objective moral values in God and moral duties in His commands. The theist thus has the explanatory resources to ground objective moral values and duties which are sorely lacking on an atheistic worldview. Hence, we may argue, one, objective moral values and duties exist. Two, but if God did not exist, objective moral values and duties would not exist. What would we follow? Therefore, God exists. Number seven, the historical facts concerning the death and resurrection of Jesus. The historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, was by all accounts a remarkable individual. New Testament historians have reached something of a consensus that Jesus of Nazareth came on the scene with an unprecedented sense of divine authority. The authority to stand and speak in the place of God Himself. He claimed that in Himself the kingdom of God had come. And as visible demonstrations of this fact, He carried out a ministry of miracles and exorcisms. That's why the Jewish authorities instigated the crucifixion on the charge of blasphemy. The supreme confirmation of Jesus' radical claim was His resurrection from the dead. If Jesus did rise from the dead, then it would seem that we have a divine evidence for the existence of God. Now, I fully appreciate that most people probably think that the resurrection of Jesus is something that they believe in. By faith. But in fact, established facts which are recognized by the majority of New Testament Christians today, which I believe are best explained by namely His empty tomb, His post-mortem appearances, and the origin of disciples' belief in His resurrection. Let me say just a brief word about each of them. Discovered empty by a group of His followers on the Sunday morning after His crucifixion. According to Dr. Kramer, Austin South, who specializes in the study of the resurrection, by far most scholars hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical about the tomb. According to D.H. Van Dyke, it is extremely difficult to object to the evidence on historical grounds. Those who deny it, he says, do so on the basis of theological or philosophical assumptions. And under a variety of circumstances, different individuals and groups of people saw appearances of Jesus alive. May be taken as historically certain that experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appears to them as the risen Christ. These appearances were witnessed not only by believers, but also by unbelievers, skeptics, and even enemies. Fact number sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite having every reason to the contrary. Think of the situation the disciples faced following Jesus' crucifixion. Number one, their leader was dead. And Jewish expectations included no idea of a Messiah. Conquering the enemies of Israel and establishing the throne of David in Jerusalem would be humiliatingly executed by the Secondly, Jewish beliefs about the afterlife, including any from the dead before the judgment at the end of the world. Nevertheless, the original disciples suddenly came to believe so strongly that they were willing to die for the truth of that belief. Luke Johnson, who is a New Testament scholar at Emory University, has written, "Some sort of powerful, transformative experience is required to generate the spiritual movement earliest Christianity was." And N.T. Wright, who is a prominent British scholar, concludes, "That as an historian, I cannot explain the rise of early Christianity leaving an empty tomb behind him." End quote. Attempts to explain away stole the body, or Jesus wasn't really dead, have been universally rejected by contemporary scholarship. No plausible naturalistic explanation of these three facts. And therefore, it seems to me, the Christian is amply justified in believing that Jesus rose from the dead and therefore was who he claimed to be. But that entails that God exists. We can summarize this argument as follows. Premise one, there are three established facts concerning the fate of Jesus of Nazareth: his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, and the very origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. Two, the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead best explains these facts. Three, the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead entails that the God revealed by Jesus of Nazareth exists, or therefore the God revealed by Jesus of Nazareth exists. And thus we have a good inductive argument for the existence of God from Jesus' resurrection. Finally, number eight, God can be personally known and experienced. Now, this last point isn't really an argument for God's existence. Rather, it's the claim that you can know that God exists wholly apart from arguments, simply by personally experiencing him. This was the way that people in the Bible knew God. As Professor John Hick explains, God was known to them as a dynamic will interacting with their own wills, a sheer reality as inescapably to be reckoned with as destructive storm and life-giving sunshine. They did not think of God as an inferred, but as an experienced reality. Adopted by the mind, but an experiential reality which gave significance to their lives. Philosophers call beliefs like this properly basic beliefs. They aren't based on other beliefs. Rather, they're part of the foundations of a person's system of beliefs. Other properly basic beliefs would include belief in the reality of the past, belief in the existence of the external world, and belief in the presence of other minds like your own. When you think about it, none of these beliefs can be proved by argument. There's no way to prove that the world was not created 5 minutes ago with built-in appearances of age, memory traces in our brains of events we never really experienced, food in our stomachs from the lunches that we never really ate. How could you prove that you're not a body lying in the matrix, wired up with electrodes and tubes, and made to believe that you're inhabiting this virtual reality so that you're you think you're a student at UTS when in fact you're a body lying in the matrix? How could you prove that the other people around you are not really soulless androids who exhibit all of the external behavior of someone with an interior life, when in fact they're actually just robotic entities and have no minds. Well, there's no way to do such things by argument. Rather, these kinds of beliefs are part of the foundation of our system of beliefs. But although these sorts of beliefs are basic for us, that doesn't mean they're arbitrary. Rather, they're grounded in the sense that they are formed in the context of certain experiences. In the experiential context of seeing and hearing and feeling things, I naturally form the belief that there is an external world of physical objects around me, which I am sensing. And thus, my basic beliefs are not arbitrary, but they are appropriately grounded in experience. There may be no way to prove such beliefs by argument, and yet you're perfectly rational to hold them. In fact, you'd have to be crazy to think that the world was really created 5 minutes ago, or that you're a body lying in the middle. Such beliefs are not merely basic for us, but they are properly basic. Now, in the same way, belief in God is, for those who see Him, a properly basic belief grounded in our belief of God. We can summarize this consideration as follows. One, beliefs which are appropriately grounded may be rationally accepted as basic beliefs, not grounded on argument. Two, belief that the biblical God exists is appropriately grounded. Three, therefore, belief that the biblical God exists may be rationally accepted as a basic belief, not grounded on argument. Now, if this is right, then there's a real danger that argument for the existence of God could actually distract your attention from God Himself. The Bible promises, draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. We mustn't so concentrate on the external arguments that we fail to hear the inner voice of God speaking to our own hearts. For those who listen, God becomes a personal reality in their lives. So, in summary then, we've seen eight features of the world around us which point beyond the world to its ground in a supernatural creator and designer of the universe. God is the best explanation of why anything at all exists. God is the best explanation of the origin of the universe. God is the best explanation of the applicability of mathematics to the physical world. God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. God is the best explanation of intentional states of consciousness in the world. God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties in the world. God is the best explanation of the historical facts concerning the death and resurrection of Jesus. And God can be personally known and experienced. I hope you see the power of the God hypothesis. It explains a vast range and diverse range of the data of human experience, and therefore, I think, is very plausibly true. And for all of these reasons and more, I therefore count myself very enthusiastically a Christian theist.
So we have time for a couple of questions. It's 10 to 2, so unfortunately we only have this room until about 2 o'clock, but a couple of quick questions from the audience. Hands up if you can...
All right, and then you'll cut me off when our time is up. Yes, in the back corner.
In Australia, a lot of people seem to want proof of existence, but it's not just any proof they want. They want a specifically scientific proof. Or, as you described earlier in your book, a pop scientific proof, not even a real scientific proof.
Sure.
with the loudness of outspoken atheism and science outreach more generally, it seems that we're seeing a questioning of those other forms of truth.
Yes.
Logical truth, but also historical truth, relational truth, experiential truth even. Should Christians then, in that context, be seeking to bring some more balance back to our culture in terms of expanding the nature of truth? And if so, how?
That is absolutely correct. As I said in my opening comments, this new atheism represents a scientism and verificationism that is completely obsolete among professional philosophers and theorists of knowledge. No one scarcely holds to this kind of scientism anymore, because there are vast ranges of truth that are not accessible to the scientific method. Logical and mathematical truths, metaphysical truths. Remember my illustrations of the existence of the external world or the reality of the past, which can't be proven scientifically. Ethical truths. You can't find moral values in a test tube. Aesthetic truths, like the good, the beautiful, is also not accessible to the scientific method. And finally, science itself, paradoxically. Science is permeated with assumptions that cannot be scientifically proven. So that if you adopted this sort of scientism, you would actually undermine and thereby destroy science itself. So this is far too narrow a criterion of rationality to be plausible. And we need to call these scientistic folks on the carpet for this. The other thing you can point out is that this claim of theirs is self-refuting, which is damning criticism. I mean, this is a decisive criticism. Consider the statement, we should only believe truths that can be scientifically proven. Can that statement be scientifically proven? No. No, it's a prescription, and therefore it's not capable of being scientifically proven. So by their own lights, if we should only believe what can be scientifically proven, we should not believe only what can be scientifically proven. The position literally is self-refuting. And so we do need to do exactly what you said and help people, not only for the sake of virtual things, but just for their good philosophical thinking. Wrest them away from this self-refuting and outrageous scientism. Yes, the gentleman here.
Back in the 50s, when we started making graphs, asking questions about what you were saying before about properly based beliefs.
Yes.
That's the idea. Am I really here?
Yes.
You guys actually on the other side of the table? And drugs seemed to help people embrace implausible concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you've got a comment about our willingness these days to accept ideas that just can't be properly based in reality.
It's
quite common today for people not to,
yes,
to think about flying saucers.
Okay, I do think proclivity among some people, because of what we just talked about, to think that because these sorts of can't be proven by argument, that therefore we don't know them. You don't really know that you're here in this room. You don't really know that the 5 minutes ago actually existed. Why? Because it can't be proved by scientific argument. That doesn't show that you don't know those things. What that shows is that the criterion of rationality that you're employing is drastically flawed. Namely, this self-refuting criterion, you're only rational to believe what can be proven by scientific method. So I would say, again, it's the same sort of question, same situation, that some people are actually led to deny things that they know because of their bad theory of knowledge and rationality. All right, thank you very much.